certainly The Wizard of Oz, and the list goes on. So what we've done at the Merriweather Group, and what I've tried to show in the book Heed Your Call, is that this formula, this hero's journey, this very, very formulaic process, can be overlaid against our lives as individuals and our businesses, and that it provides a very thoughtful map for us as to how to go forward in our lives and our businesses in a way that creates authenticity, purpose, and meaning, but also wealth and abundance.
Now, part of this hero's journey, and you spend quite a bit of autobiographical time in the book, as well as stories of many other people, are meeting challenges and dealing with pitfalls where the hero is falling into what you call the abyss.
Yes. Thanks. Yes, absolutely. And also, thank you for noting that, you know, the book Heed Your Call is very autobiographical. And I made a very very personal and very important decision in writing the book to share my story, for better or worse, for a few reasons. One, as a reader and a seeker and a person who's involved in business, I tend to get frustrated when I feel things are provided in a way that's purely theoretical. So I wanted there to be some actual real-world grounding and actual examples of people's lives, mine and others. And secondly, I wanted to show the reader that I am them. There is no difference. You know, it's not that some of us are better or somehow smarter than the others. I'm one of them. You know, I'm just an average guy who grew up in an average home in an average community who had the fortune to learn some of these constructs and have some guides and mentors along the way that helped me. And your question on the abyss is an important one. Each hero, each of us in our journey will succumb to those moments where we sort of have to fall to our knees and say, I'm over my head. I can't do this. I don't have the tools, the skills, the requisite experience. And you know what? That's okay. In fact, not only is it okay, it's a requirement. In Campbell's work on the hero's journey, that moment of abyss is what allows the hero to finally come to a place where they're open to the guides and mentors. So the Buddha saying that the teacher appears when the student is ready. Prior to having that moment where you really get knocked on the head, we aren't open to receiving outside advice and counsel because our ego tells us we know it all. It's when we surrender and we finally give up and we finally capitulate that actually possibility is the highest, opportunity is the highest, and creativity is the highest. Now, that's very contrary to what we're taught in school and most of our parenting and societally. We're taught failure or surrender is weakness. It is quitting. It is succumbing. And my experience in business and life couldn't be more in opposite to that. That it's when we finally do let go that we actually can become.
You say when we arrive at a place of trust, surrendering to something bigger than ourselves and choose to live in flow, miracles can happen. I think people have a hard time considering that even the experience of the abyss is part of the flow or the ebb and flow.
Absolutely. And I want to thank you for bringing that piece of the book out because it's a critical component. So many of us, and I am one of them, are enslaved to that fear, that ego that says, if you let go, if you surrender, if you choose to sort of step out of your known world, oh my God, you're going to lose your house, your car is going to get repoed, you know, your spouse is going to leave you, you're going to go broke and end up on the streets. And that is an incredibly powerful limiting voice within each of us. And it prevents most of us from actually acting on what our soul's greatest desire is for us. And we end up living the life of Willy Loman. You know, we do not step out of the known world. And in the research I did for the book Heed Your Call, I spoke with a number of end-of-life caregivers through the hospice network. And uniquely, these caregivers shared with me that the single most common statement by folks as they're reaching the end of this particular life is, you know, I played it safe. I didn't take my shot. I didn't listen to that voice inside me that told me, go do this. I was scared. I was in a place of fear. And as a result, I lived an inauthentic life. To me, that's the greatest failure we can have. Not trying things and having them not work out. That's okay. But playing it safe and mailing it in.
So do you think that everybody is wired for risk-taking? That the hero's journey is something that everybody ought to undertake?
I do. And, you know, I looked at this from a number of different perspectives. Judeo-Christian, Buddhism, physics, art, psychology, and illustrated in each of these disciplines is really these same constructs. They use different words, but they illustrate the same construct. So let me give you a couple examples. So in sort of psychology, there's a great story of a very well-known, very well-respected psychologist who had a deep fear of snakes, a deep fear. And so he took himself to his local zoo and went into the sort of reptile area and sought out the most deadly, as he referred to it, viper. And this viper was encased in bulletproof glass, 2 inches thick on each of the walls, and he said to himself for 30 minutes as he stood 5 or 6 feet back from the cage, that snake cannot get me. It is behind 2 inches of bulletproof glass. It would take a cannon in order to open that up. It cannot get me. So he reasoned and rationalized with his own mind. Then at the end of 30 minutes, he walked up to the cage and he pressed his nose against it. And of course, the viper coiled back and shout out at him, and you know what he did? He jumped 5 feet back. Too many of us live our lives that way. You know, we can look outside and see it's not snowing, and we can know it's July, but we put on a metaphoric winter coat because we are so consumed by fear and by the ego telling us, if you don't do this or you do this, you're going to get hurt. And as a result, we don't take our shot. In the Judeo-Christian belief system, in the liturgy, there is this Hebrew phrase, tikkun olam, which translates into repair the world. Now, most people in the Jewish faith have adopted that phrase to mean philanthropy. Write checks, be generous, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if you read further in the liturgy, what it says is the way we create tikkun olam is to return to the Ruach Elohim, the breath of God that is within each of us. So to your question of, is it incumbent upon each of us to heed our call and to take the shot, I would say yes. Not only does that help us in our individual lives, but through returning to our Ruach, our purpose, our divine spark, we collectively help to create tikkun olam. So we repair the world by doing what we're meant to do.
Right. Now, that doesn't necessarily entail entrepreneurial pursuits, although that's what your business, what Meriwether Group focuses on. It could be somebody whose path of heroism is more mundane or less glamorous, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, and I appreciate that because I have had some readers say, I love your book, but not all of us can go out and create a multi-million-dollar company. If my heroic purpose is something else, does that mean I'm not as good? And the answer is no. I mean, and in a book, I refer to my friend Peter, who's a caretaker of plants. And his purpose, his reason for being is he brings beautiful plants into people's homes and offices. He is incredibly passionate about it. He knows how much light they need, how much water they need to drink, what energy they tend to bring into the space. He can read people and the space and environment and really bring that incredible beauty. That's his heroic purpose. And you know what? That's as important as anyone else's.
You know, it occurs to me that the very same activity could be heroic or could be a way to play it safe, depending on a person's orientation.
Yes.
Like, for instance, take parenting, for instance. I mean, I can see how parenting could be a heroic quest if somebody was, you know, really had it as a calling. Mm-hmm. But then I can also see how parenting is a way to play it safe as a default choice for people who don't want to take any risks.
Absolutely. I think often what we call our medicine is actually our poison. So we will, to your point, find things that are societally acceptable.
Right.
And we'll say, oh, no, I can't go do this or that thing because I'm focused on parenting or I'm focused on my neighborhood association. And it's a a nice and generally accepted way of creating an excuse for not stepping into yourself.
Right. So how do you propose that people discover what their journey ought to be, or what their highest calling might be?
Yeah. So
heed your call. How do you know your call?
Threshold important question. And the answer is maybe going to be less grand than the listener would want. It doesn't mean you have to move to India. It does not mean you have to change your religion, put on a turban, or sit on a meditation cushion all day long. It does not mean that you have to read a dozen self-help books. What it means is you have to take time to get in touch with your centered, all-knowing soul. And what that means is, and it's different for each of us, but it probably means you got to put your device down every once in a while and get off Angry Birds. You have to go into nature and take a walk. You have to give yourself a few moments every day where you just breathe. When you do that, my experience and the experience of others I've worked with, invested in, advised, and counseled, is your nature, your witnessing self, the true centered you, will start to actually show you what it is you're meant to do. Many of us are afraid of that voice. I would say the vast majority of your listeners right now are shaking their head up and down, nodding yes, and saying, yes, he's right. Those few moments when I have done that, I hear that voice. But you know what? That voice scares me.
Right.
Because that voice is pushing me to change the status quo. Mm-hmm. So when I hear that voice, I'm activated to shut it down. And I do that through a cold beer or a sports game or picking up my phone or getting on email or working a lot of hours.
Mm-hmm.
And we do so much and spend so much time and energy to quiet that voice down.
By keeping busy.
Keeping busy.
Distracted.
Distractions. And some of them could be good things. Exercising,
mm-hmm.
Volunteering our time. Don't get me wrong. It's shadow and light. But each of those things can cause us to not spend the few moments we need to actually get in touch with that centered self, that part of us that really wants to tell us what we should be doing.
Let's talk about business for a second, because you've got a very kind of spiritual orientation to the role of business in the world and the importance of business. Let me start by asking, why do you consider entrepreneurs to be heroic?
I believe that an entrepreneur is the modern day hero. And, you know, the hero historically in myth was really sort of defined as the king or the queen or the sorceress, the wizard. And then, you know, later Joseph Campbell further extended the definition to include the artist and the musician and the scientist. And it's my belief that the entrepreneur is the modern day hero. And when I say entrepreneur, I mean anybody who is bringing a spirit into the world around disrupting the status quo, who looks at the world and says, where has the consumer or humanity been deprived of innovation, relevancy, newness? Where have we fallen short of evolution or revolution?
Mm-hmm.
That mindset, that person, in my estimation, has the ability to change the way that we interact with each other, ourselves, and the world in ways that politicians, government, NGOs cannot.
But a lot of entrepreneurs are just, you know, figuring out a better way to do something like sell books or
sure.
or whatever. Are they really changing the world?
I believe they are. So let's use an example. Dave Dahl from Dave's Killer Breads, a mm-hmm. company here in Portland. You know, Dave, many of your listeners will know his story, was a 15-year felon. And during his last 5 years in prison, he learned about health and wellness and meditation, got in touch with himself, got some mental health counseling and help, and had a vision and an intention around how to bring bread into the world in a way that would be evolutionary or revolutionary. So he came out and started this company making vegan, organic, healthy, but also fun, great-tasting, and irreverent bread. And if you think about this, Paul, you know, bread is a staple for folks. I mean, in terms of what we eat and feed our kids with and our communities with. And prior to Dave's Killer Breads, I would argue, pun intended, the category was very stale. It was a sea of sameness, a lot of white bread, a lot of brown bread. But along comes this innovation, and you could say, well, he's just an innovator that made some bread. But really what he did is he completely revolutionized the category. And now my kids are chomping on organic, vegan, healthy, fair trade bread and not saying, Mom, quit buying me this brown stuff. I don't like it. I need the Wonder Bread. That has a real effect in the world, and a very positive one.
You know, one of the hard things about succeeding as an entrepreneur is getting the timing right. You know, I used to say that you want to be 6 to 9 months ahead of the market, but you don't want to be 5 years ahead of the market.
No.
And it reminds me of what you write in your book about your grandfather's definition of genius.
Yes. So my grandfather, who was an immigrant and not a traditionally educated gentleman, but who was very in touch with his intuition, said to me many times, you know, David, genius is nothing more than knowing what the collective consciousness wants about 10 minutes before they know they want it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really true. Each one of us has the ability, each one of us has the ability to sort of intuit where the market, where the world, where the consumer is going. We are all connected by that ruach, by that breath. And so if you give yourself the opportunity to tap into that, you can have a real good sense of kind of what's next and what is necessary in the world. How many of us have said, I thought of that, but I just didn't think about doing anything. And now, look, there it is. What we can do is actually activate around that stuff. And it doesn't mean you have to go start a business, but you can start bringing it into your life.
Right, right. You tell in the book how the business that your wife started,
yes,
Oregon Chai, provided important learning for you, and I think, you know, was an impetus toward the eventual development of the Meriwether Group.
Absolutely. So my wife, Heather, at the time of Oregon Chai, my girlfriend, is a very creative, I think you'd say sort of hippie-ish, in the moment, birther of beauty and ideas, but she has no tolerance or interest in kind of the blocking and tackling traditional sort of business aspects. So in our early 20s, one rainy day in Portland, she said to me, gosh, you know, look at what Starbucks is doing with coffee. And they were just getting going. And she said, you know, but if you drink tea, you're still sort of relegated to like a hot mug of water and a bag of tea. And that's not as fun or as cool as having a cappuccino or a latte. And she said, remember that chai stuff that we used to drink when we traveled in Southeast Asia or we were in Boulder, Colorado or Santa Cruz? I said, yeah, that stuff's great. She said, I'm going to start a company making chai. And I know exactly what it's going to taste like, and I'm going to make it organic and fair trade. And Paul, this is before anyone was doing organic and fair trade. And she said, because that's what the world needs and wants. And I want someone, you know, in Iowa or Kansas or Florida to be able to pick up this mug of chai, of Oregon chai, and when they drink it and they smell it, I want for that minute for them to be transported to the Himalayas. I want to give people that experience. And she was so passionate. But then she looked at me and she said, but you know what? I don't want to have to do anything other than that. And I said, well, that's great because I can't do that, but I know how to go write a business plan and to do a supply chain analysis and to get a permit and to do distribution agreements and to look at how we scale and grow this and finance it and build it. And unknowingly at the time, we hit on what I now refer to in the book, Heed Your Call, as the power of and.
Yeah.
How to combine those things.
Right.
Left brain and right brain.
Right.
And, you know, what we kind of stumbled upon, and now it's a hallmark of the Meriwether Group's approach to advising and guiding businesses, is when an individual or a company blends analytics and artistry, intuition and profit and loss, purpose and meaning and a balance sheet, that's where the magic happens. It's not enough anymore just to have kind of a heart-centered, founder-oriented, beautiful consumer business that has tons of culture and meaning, but where you don't know how to balance the checkbook. But it's also not enough to have a company that's super crisp on operations and finance, but doesn't have a heart and soul.
I'm curious if you were very conflicted back in the day when your wife comes up with this idea and maybe responded with the completely rational response of, Well, honey, you don't really know anything about the tea business.
I absolutely did. You know, what I said to her is, hey, are you sure you really want to do this? I mean, you got this college education and this master's degree, and we're trying to get a family started, and, you know, this sounds like pretty high risk. And, you know, she looked at me and she said, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to do this. And my ego and my fear and my upbringing, you know, was screaming at me. This is not prudent. This is not wise. This is too big of a risk. Oh, my God, how are we going to do the things that society tells us we need to do? But I sat with it, you know, and I looked that fear in the eye, and I breathed, and I watched my wife's passion and her heart and her desire and her intention. And slowly, I started to let go and surrender and trust and believe. And she became a guide and mentor for me at that point, and really taught me what it was like to actually find success through surrender.
Right, and look at what's resulted from that. You learned a lesson from that that's changed your life and changed the life of all of these companies that the Meriwether Group has been able to help. Let me, we're approaching the end of our time, and I want to make sure to ask you, how does the journey end? Does the entrepreneur ever complete his or her journey? Does the hero ever complete
the
journey?
Yeah. So, you know, in myth, and according to Joseph Campbell, there is this sort of jumping off. There is the abyss, which we've talked about. Then you sort of continue on your path and you obtain the tools that you need. And those often come to you through guides and mentors. Mm-hmm. And then you reach this defining moment, this moment of the culmination of your journey and of this journey. And, you know, if we all remember back to The Wizard of Oz, you know, this is Dorothy leaving Kansas, going to Oz, realizing that she's got a big bad witch coming after her, meeting her mentors and guides and the Scarecrow and the Tin Man and the Lion, and then arriving at the Emerald City and to what she thought was her defining moment of meeting the wizard. But, of course, there isn't a wizard. And she's initially disappointed, and then Glinda the Good Witch says to her, silly girl, all you have to do is click your heels together three times. You are the hero of your own journey. It doesn't lie outside you. And Paul, that's always the culmination of the journey, that you finally get to a place in your journey, your path, your life, where you recognize that you, in fact, are the hero of your own life. And that in doing that, you then can return to the known world. You can go back to your Kansas, but the world's different and you're different for having taken the journey. And that is the Tikkun Olam. That is the healing.
Mm-hmm. Let's make sure to tell people about your website, because we're almost completely out of time. It's heedyourcall.com.
That's correct. So the book can be bought at heedyourcall.com or at Amazon, at Powell's or any other local bookstore. And then my company's email or website is www.meriwethergroup.com. And that's our business of helping companies with their growth goals and objectives.
How do you spell meriwether.com?
MeriwetherGroup.com.
Meriwethergroup.com. Well, thank you, David.
Thanks, Paul.
I would love to talk much longer, but I'm afraid we have run out of time.
I really appreciate this time, and thank you to you and your listeners.
And for those who tuned in late today, this is Paul O'Brien. And in a second, I'll tell you how you can replay the entire interview with David Howitt anytime you want via podcast on the internet. Today, we've been visiting with David Howitt, author of the new book, Heed Your Call. And I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pathways interview program, which is made possible in part by a grant from the Divination Foundation. Information at divination.com, spelled divination.com. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. This is your host, Paul O'Brien, reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways and its podcasts, the interview program dedicated to personal and cultural transformation. Thanks again for tuning in and being a part of it.
zover zijn. Die vertrouwde klanken van de kinderen die zingen van Hollands glorie. Het is weer tijd voor het Hollands uurtje. Goedemorgen. En ik heet Charles. En ik doe het elke twee weken. En dit is gezellig jullie erbij te hebben. Gaat bovenal. Het is fris geluid van de jonge knapen daar. En dat is het begin van het programma. En zeer zeker een goede leuze. Hollands glorie. Nou, we gaan naar het zingen van Wietige van Dort. Zij doet altijd een mooi programma. En hier is het gezellige liedje van de schoolbanken nog. In het groene dal, in het stille dal, waar de bloempjes bloeien.
Thank you.
Ja, mooi gedaan. Wieteke van Dort. En in het groene dal, in het stille dal. Little song we sang way back in grade school. One of the almost folk songs of Holland. Wieteke van Dort. Now something a little bit more up scale, up tempo I should say. Breng eens een zonnetje onder de mensen. Bring a little sunshine amongst the people. Here is a very famous Italian tenor opera singer from Holland, Willy Alberti, and the man of the Amsterdam song Johnny Jordaan. En dat liedje van Breng eens een zonnetje. Een beetje meer uptempo.
Doet je toch goed? Vervul zo nu en dag de liefste wensen.